currently on a tour of the West Coast. Also joining us are young filmmakers from Free Arts Northwest, as well as Hannah Piper Burns and Benjamin Pop of the Experimental Film Festival. But up next, it is Flashpoints. That's coming up next on KBOO. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can still join or renew by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate today.
Native American Business Network is holding its 12th annual Trading at the River Conference and Native Marketplace at Lewis and Clark College, May 27th through the 29th. ONABEN is a nonprofit public benefit corporation created by Northwest Tribes to increase the success of private businesses owned by Native Americans. Trading at the River features inspirational speakers, informative panels, and valuable workshops for small business owners and economic development organizations. ONABEN also welcomes community members to come check out the Native Marketplace, a highlight of the event, which features over 20 Native vendors. It is open to the public from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., May 29th at Lewis and Clark College at Smith Hall. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found on kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Today on Flashpoints, a new speech by Noam Chomsky and a special report from Alejandro Reyes on the ongoing government attacks in Chiapas. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are proud to present a brand new speech by Noam Chomsky, taking a look at the global politics of American wars around the world.
A leading principle of international relations theory is that the highest priority of states is to ensure security. Standard formulation by George Kennan, one of the planners of the post-war world. As he put it, government is created to assure order and justice internally and provide for the common defense, what's called national security. And the proposition seems plausible, almost self-evident, until you begin to look more closely and ask the question, security for whom? For the general population, for state power itself, for dominant domestic constituencies, depending on what we mean, the credibility of the proposition ranges from very high to negligible. So security for state power, for example, is ranked very high. That's illustrated by the great efforts that states exert to protect themselves from their own populations, even from the scrutiny of their populations. Edward Snowden explained his actions by saying that what he said, the public had a right to know about these programs, the public had a right to know that which the government is doing in its name, and that which the government is doing against the public. And the same could be justly said by Dan Ellsberg, Chelsea Manning, and other courageous figures who've acted on the same democratic principle. The government's stance, of course, is quite different. It's that the public does not have a right to know because security is undermined, severely undermined, so it's asserted. There are several good reasons to be skeptical about a response like that. The first is that it's almost completely predictable. That's what a government says whenever a government act is exposed. It's reflexive. And being predictable, it carries little or no information. A second reason for skepticism is the nature of the evidence presented. It was actually reviewed by well-known international relations scholar John Rearsheimer. He writes that the Obama administration, not surprisingly, initially claimed that the NSA's spying played a key role in thwarting 54 terrorist plots against the United States, implying that it violated the Fourth Amendment for a good reason. This was a lie, however. General Keith Alexander, the NSA director, eventually admitted to Congress that he could claim only one success. That involved catching a Somali immigrant living in San Diego who had sent $8,500 to a terrorist group in Somalia. That's what this huge operation has succeeded in achieving so far. Well, there is a sense in which security is threatened by public awareness, and namely security of state power from exposure. And that's important. The basic insight was expressed very well by distinguished political scientist who held the chair of science of government at Harvard University, Samuel Huntington. He pointed out that the architects of power in the United States must create a force that can be felt but not seen. Power remains strong when it remains in the dark. Exposed to the sunlight, it begins to evaporate. That, incidentally, is in favor of secrecy if you go on with the rest of the discussion. In the US as elsewhere, the architects of power understand this all too well, of course. People who have worked through the huge mass of documents declassified by the government can hardly fail to notice how frequently it is security of state power from the domestic public that's a prime concern, and not national security in any meaningful sense. Often, security is motivated by the need to guarantee the security of powerful domestic sectors. In the United States, that means the corporate sector. One persistent example of this is the mislabeled free trade agreements. They're mislabeled. They're not free trade agreements. They radically violate free trade principles. They're substantially not about trade at all, but rather about investor rights. And they're certainly not agreements, at least if people are part of their countries. People, when they know about them, are usually opposed. These instruments are regularly negotiated in secret, like the current transatlantic, trans-Pacific partnership, huge treaties being negotiated. Not entirely in secret, of course. They're not secret from the hundreds of corporate lobbyists and lawyers who are writing the details of the agreements with an impact that's not too hard to guess, and in fact is revealed by the few parts that have been exposed through WikiLeaks. Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate in economics, reasonably concludes that, as he puts it, with the U.S. Trade Representative's office representing corporate interests, not those of the public, the likelihood that what emerges from the coming talks will serve ordinary Americans' interests is low. The outlook for ordinary citizens in other countries is even bleaker. And the record well supports that, including NAFTA. So security of the secrecy makes sense there, just as in the case of the NSA secrecy. There is real interests that are being secured, but against the population, not of the population. And security of domestic constituencies means the corporate sector. That's a regular concern of government policy, and that's hardly surprising, given their role in formulating the policy in the first place. Examples are too numerous to mention, so I'll skip them. Let's turn to the third interpretation of security, security for the domestic population. In sharp contrast, there's substantial evidence that That kind of security, what's called national security, is just not a high priority for state policy. Now, there are plenty of illustrations. One current one is the global terror campaign that Obama is carrying out, completely unprecedented campaign of global terror, carrying out with great enthusiasm, and in fact, the war on terror generally, since it was declared by Ronald Reagan in 1981, redeclared by Bush 20 years later. And more strikingly, it's also true of strategic planning, nuclear policy in particular, to an extent that's not properly recognized. So let's have a look at a few cases. Start with the case of so-called war on terror. So take, for example, the assassination of Osama bin Laden. President Obama, as I'm sure you recall, brought it up with pride in an important speech on national security last May, very widely covered. But there was one crucial paragraph that was ignored. Obama hailed the operation, took credit for it, but he said it cannot be the norm. And the reason he said is that the risks were immense. The Navy SEALs, I'm quoting, might have been embroiled in an extended firefight. But by luck, he said, that didn't happen. Nevertheless, the cost to our relationship with Pakistan and the backlash among the Pakistani public over encroachment on their territory, aggression when others do it, was severe. Well, let's add a few details that he didn't mention. The SEALs were under orders to fight their way out if they were apprehended. They would not have been left to their fate if they had been, as Obama put it, embroiled in an extended firefight. The full force of the U.S. military would have been used to extricate them. Pakistan has a powerful military, well-trained, highly protective of state sovereignty, and of course it has nuclear weapons. And Pakistani specialists are quite concerned about penetration of the security system by jihadi elements. Their presence is itself a consequence of the massive terror campaign. It's also no secret that the population of Pakistan has been embittered and radicalized by the drone terror campaign and other U.S. policies, including pressuring the Pakistani military to attack tribal regions that had been left to their own by the British imperialists and their Pakistani successors. While the SEALs were still in the bin Laden compound, Pakistani Chief of Staff Kayani was informed of the invasion, and he ordered his staff, his words, to confront any unidentified aircraft. He assumed they were probably from India. Meanwhile, in Kabul, right down the road, General Petraeus ordered U.S. warplanes to respond if Pakistanis scrambled their fighter jets. Well, as Obama said, the worst didn't happen by luck, and it could have been quite ugly. Could have been nuclear war. But the risks were faced without noticeable concern or subsequent comment, which is also interesting. Well, there's a lot more to say about that operation, and it's actually quite immense cost to Pakistan. But instead, let's look more closely at the concern for security more generally, beginning with security from terror, then turning to the much more important question of security from instant destruction by nuclear weapons. So Obama's global assassination campaign, as I said, by far the world's worst terrorist campaign, never been anything like it. It's also a terror-generating campaign, and that's well understood at the highest levels. So, for example, General McChrystal, former head of U.S. forces in Afghanistan after Iraq, he pointed out that for every innocent person you kill, you create 10 new enemies. Actually, the concept of innocent person, which is now standard in U.S. discourse, it tells you how far we've progressed in the last 800 years. Next year is the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, which established the principle of presumption of innocence. person's innocent until proven guilty in a proper trial with a jury of peers. Now, that was the foundation of Anglo-American law, but that's ancient history. By now, the word guilty has a different meaning. It means targeted for assassination by President Obama. And the word innocent means not yet accorded that status, though he might be next Tuesday in the president's assassination meetings. A couple of days after the Boston Marathon bombing, Obama ordered an assassination in a remote Yemeni village. Actually, we rarely learn about such crimes, but it happened that there was a young man from the village in the United States, and he testified about the operation before a Senate committee. He reported that for years, the jihadis had been trying to turn the villagers against the United States, but they had failed. The villagers knew nothing about the United States except what he was writing about it, and he liked the United States. But he said one drone murder in the village, actually a murder of a person who could easily have been apprehended, one drone murder vindicated jihadi propaganda, turned the whole village into people who hate America and want to retaliate against it, once again swelling the ranks of the terrorist networks that have proliferated under the war on terror. They're now all over large parts of the world and deeply motivated for revenge, not surprisingly. You can act how we would react under similar circumstances. Well, meanwhile, we're developing the technology to facilitate terror targeting ourselves. There's an article in Britain's leading journal of international affairs, David Hastings Dunn, a recent article. He outlines how the increasingly sophisticated drones that we're developing